Hello and welcome to the Investors Chronicles Personal Finance Podcast. I'm Moira O'Neill and joining me in the studio today are my colleagues on the personal finance team, Leonora Walters and Kate Bearley. We're also delighted to have a special guest on the show. Alan Steele is chairman of Alan Steele Asset Management and he will be helping me make sense of asset allocation and how this should change or not as we get older. We're also going to look at investment trust boards and how proactive they should be in making manager changes. Also, you may not have considered investing in bonds via exchange-traded funds, but this is becoming a more interesting area that we'll look at. And we're also going to have a quick look at the performance of F&C Global Smaller Companies Investment Trust. But first, we have a special interview with Sam Morse, who is fund manager of Fidelity European Values, which is a member of the Investors Chronicles Top 100 Funds. Leonora and Kate interviewed him earlier today, and investors who are troubled by the Greek crisis and its impact on markets may be surprised to hear what he has to say about value in European companies.
This week, Greece has been dominating the headlines, and you're obviously a Europe fund manager. Do you have any exposure to Greece, and are you concerned at all about any effects it might have on other portfolio holdings?
There are no Greek holdings in the European Values Investment Trust. Generally, events in Greece certainly have effect on, you know, the sentiment towards Europe. But in reality, the direct impact on most of the companies held in the portfolio is relatively small. In terms of the future for Greece, obviously, it's a complex situation. Many twists and turns, and we won't really know how things will end up there. My very basic view is that if Greece were to leave the Eurozone, that would certainly cause some uncertainty in Europe, which probably wouldn't be helpful to markets or perhaps to the economy in the shorter term. And in addition to that, it would demonstrate that the membership of the Eurozone is reversible. So I think it would probably have a longer term impact on equity risk premiums in Southern Europe, which again generally wouldn't be helpful for holdings in countries like Spain, Italy, etc. But really the whole point of the portfolio is to focus on companies. It is about bottom-up stock picking and to try and choose those companies which will be able to deliver consistent dividend growth on a 3 to 5 year view that in my view are attractively valued. And to a certain extent, you know, these macro risks are diversified through, you know, holding a decent portfolio of names in that respect.
But before we move on to some kind of more of the bottom up, I'm just curious as obviously another big trend in Europe has been QE, and curious as to what that's meant for the environment for stock pickers, because obviously QE has really pushed up equities. What has that meant in terms of the opportunities for you?
Yeah, I mean, I think, again, the impact of QE is uncertain. As you point out, generally, it appears to be good for asset prices, but the actual impact on the economy, I think, is more debatable. I think it has some impact, in particular, for instance, on financials, where it's difficult for banks in particular to earn money on their deposits. Certainly we've seen that in terms of net interest margins for banks. I wouldn't say that my starting point is to look for particular stocks that benefit from the effects of QE or vice versa. I really start with the companies and their fundamental outlook, and then try to decide how these macro factors, such as QE and events in Greece, etc., might affect the portfolio as a whole, and try to, in a sense, minimize the impact of these events through diversification.
And, I mean, how easy have you been finding it to identify those good opportunities, but at the right price? I mean, how how are kind of the stocks in terms of being cheap or expensive at the moment?
Yeah, I think generally stocks in Europe are expensive. You know, generally, yeah, the stock market cycle is a bit different from the economic cycle. And as Sir John Templeton said, bull markets very much and very often start when people are most pessimistic and mature on skepticism and then die on euphoria. And I think it's fair to say that, you know, 6 years or so ago in 2009, during the global financial crisis, everyone was extremely pessimistic about the outlook for companies and stocks. But actually, they're extremely cheap. Since then, obviously, markets have risen a lot. And gradually, commentators have become more optimistic. I'll leave you to decide whether they're currently euphoric. And that's reflected in valuations. And although valuations in Europe may appear a little bit less exuberant than in the States, I think we're at that stage in the cycle where valuations are high, certainly higher than average, and perhaps even becoming dangerously high. And that is a challenge for me as a stock picker. But having said that, I always the fund is always fully invested because generally I take the view that the investors have given me the money to invest, and you know they can take the decision to sell the fund and hold it in cash. And I think it's better just to be clearer with them that is what I'll do. So I am struggling with absolute valuations. So we have to look to a certain extent for stocks that are relatively attractive, given their dividend prospects. And I think there are some opportunities there.
And let's talk a bit about your portfolio, because your top holding is 3i Group, isn't it, currently? And that's a private equity company. So why do you like that one so much?
Well, my top holding is probably actually a company like Nestle, but I think you're probably looking there at a relative or what we might call an active position, i.e. a difference between the percentage in the portfolio and the percentage that stock represents in the benchmark. And 3i is certainly close to the top of the list. It's an interesting situation. There's been some management change a couple of years ago. A chap called Simon Burrows, who had a background as an investment banker, became the new chief executive, and I think has done some very sensible things in terms of reducing the cost base of the business, in terms of reducing the number of holdings within their portfolio, and really focusing on the quality of those investments as well. He's also reduced the financial leverage of the company to leave it with a little bit of powder dry in the event that things were to turn down. So I think that's still a very attractive and interesting story. And it's interesting that actually of my sort of top 10 active holdings in the fund, about six currently are financials. And although the fund is quite broadly diversified by sector and it's not massively overweight financials, I think there are some really good opportunities in the financial sector because it is still and has been relatively unloved given various challenges, etc. And so I think we can still find companies that we think on a 3 to 5 year view will show very attractive dividend growth from really quite an interesting level of dividend yield.
And I mean, what would be examples of...
Well, I think a good example there would be Intesa Sanpaolo, which is an Italian bank. You know, I think this, it's a conservatively managed bank. It's 90% focused on Italy, not a GC fee. And again, it's really about an internal turnaround under new management who are looking to take some costs out and also improve the growth of the business through growth in their asset management business. But also, you know, it will benefit from changes in the external environment, in particular into the industry structure in Italy, which was dominated for many years by sort of a fragmentation due to a large number of sort of local mutual banks. And you may have seen recently in Italy, there's been some legal changes, which means that these popolari banks will have to become joint stock holding companies, which is likely to lead to a lot of consolidation. And we think that will improve the profitability of the Italian banking system. There's also been some legal changes recently in respect of non-performing loans. And so we think the industry structure is improving. We think the Italian economy is improving a little bit. We think there's a good internal turnaround situation at Intesa. And a lot of their business plan really revolves around paying out more in dividends and growing the dividends from quite an attractive level. The yield's around 4% for next year. We think that will grow to as much as 7 or 8% in 2 or 3 years' time.
And on the flip side to that, two of the top constituents in the index you follow, and that's the FTSE Europe ex-UK, Novartis and Bayer, but you don't hold any of those stocks, is that correct?
That is correct. I mean, I do pay attention to the benchmark in terms of running this fund, and that's a slight differentiator perhaps from other funds. It is a mainstream approach. And but having said that, if I don't like a stock, I won't hold it in the portfolio, irrelevant of the size of the fund in the benchmark. And obviously Novartis, as you say, is one of the biggest companies in Europe. So that is quite a big underweight position. I think Novartis is a fine company. It meets the criteria that I look for when investing in companies. It has a dividend, it's growing the dividend, it's cash generative, it has a strong balance sheet. But the one issue I have is that I think it is still facing quite a lot of patent expiries over the next 3 to 5 years in the shorter term, Gleevec. And then it's got 2 or 3 other important drugs that are going off patent around 2019 and 2020. And I think this will prove to be quite a headwind for them in terms of growing their earnings and dividends looking forwards. And the stock has enjoyed quite a re-rating, so it's not particularly cheap relative to other pharmaceutical companies in Europe. And I think I can find better opportunities within the sector for the fund. So Roche, Novo Nordisk and Sanofi are 3 big holdings in the fund, and to be quite frank, I prefer those from the point of view of dividend yield and dividend growth on a 3 to 5 year view.
Okay, now obviously you're a big fan of Nestle, aren't you? And that derives a large chunk of its earnings from emerging markets. Are you conscious of looking for companies which derive a big portion of their revenue overseas?
Again, I try to run the fund on a diversified basis to try and limit or dampen down the risk of exposure to various macro factors or external changes such as, you know, emerging markets, etc. So I suspect that given that diversification, the portfolio is fairly broadly balanced relative to the benchmark in terms of exposure to emerging markets or exposure to international sales. I do like Nestle as an investment. Again, you know, the dividend yield is around 3%. They've got a fantastic long-term track record of growing the dividend. The dividend's paid in Swiss franc, as you will know, which generally tends to appreciate versus the euro. I think that's an attractive combination. It's got a strong balance sheet. It generates cash. And I think the fundamentals in the longer term are positive, particularly because the company, which has done a very good job over the longer term of growing its sales and its margins, is now also very much focused on the third leg, i.e. return on capital. I think that that's now, you know, going to come through in terms of more active portfolio management. More of a focus on the return that they're getting on the very strong investment they're making in the business. There is quite a big emerging market exposure in the company, generally, and I think, you know, generally things have become tougher externally in the emerging markets, but also we are seeing a lot more competition from other emerging market players. So that is an issue that I've got to keep an eye on. But generally, Nestlé seems to be weathering that storm reasonably well and continuing to grow its dividends at an attractive rate.
Okay, now at your last AGM in December, shareholders voted to allow up to 20% of the company's assets to be invested in the UK. And that's up from 5%, wasn't it? Now, why was that change made? And have you made more investments in the UK as a result?
Yeah, I'd just like to clarify that a little bit. I mean, the permission to invest up to 20% is in UK listed names, so not necessarily in the UK economy. And as you all know, you know, the UK stock market has become quite global, and a lot of those UK companies maybe do a big proportion of their business in continental Europe, a bit like 3i. So I don't think it should be seen as taking this fund away from primarily being focused on investments in continental Europe. And secondly, what we really did actually was remove a rather artificial and anachronistic cap on UK listed names at 5%. So the fund always had the freedom to invest up to 20% off benchmark in countries outside the benchmark, and that remains the case. So it's very unlikely the UK listed names will become 20% of the benchmark, because, you know, I want to use that flexibility or freedom to invest in other countries that are outside the benchmark. So this will remain very much a continental European fund. But having said that, there are certain situations, for instance, Royal Dutch Shell, where there's a Dutch listing and a UK listing. And traditionally, the UK listing has been more expensive than the Dutch listing. So it's made sense to hold the Dutch listed shares. But that's actually changed quite recently, partly as a result of the BG deal. So now the UK listed shares are pretty much on a par with the Dutch listed shares, and if they were to come that much cheaper than the Dutch listed shares, then I'd like to have that flexibility to shift my holding from one into the other, which would probably take me over the 5%, you know, artificial limit. So that's one reason for allowing greater flexibility. And secondly, you know, our research department is organized on a pan-European basis, and quite often you and an analyst will come up to me and say, look, Sam, you own X stock in Europe that's listed in Europe, but our, you know, this business is very similar in terms of where it does its business, etc. I think it's a much more attractive candidate, and I'd rather you owned it, but it happens to be listed in the UK. So we're not changing the spirit of the fund in terms of, you know, this is a fund all about investing into continental Europe, but we are giving ourselves a little bit more flexibility in terms of investing in UK listed names.
Okay, and at the same meeting, it was kind of decided that you would be able to use a slightly wider range of derivatives as well, wasn't it? And what does that mean?
Yes, I mean, it's important to understand we were already using derivatives in the investment trust for gearing purposes. So for some time we've been using CFDs or contracts for differences, going long these effectively to increase the gearing in the fund. You know, the support infrastructure, the oversight, etc., has all been tested while we've been doing that. And Fidelity generally has been building up quite a lot of resources in this area over the years. So we now have analysts who, you know, specifically looking at shorting opportunities. And we have, you know, a team looking at derivatives and, you know, with good infrastructure on oversight and settlement, etc. So a number of other funds at Fidelity have been using derivatives more broadly for many years. And I felt that it was important for the holders of the trust to benefit from these changes too. So again, it's about flexibility. We now have a bit more flexibility, for instance, if necessary, to short single stock names by going short CFDs. I could look to magnify my style a little bit by increasing the investments in the stocks I hold and then effectively shorting the benchmark through index futures. So again, it's just really more tools in the kit bag to try and continue the longer term outperformance of the trust relative to the benchmark.
And yeah, we should talk about that performance. Now, you've obviously outperformed the benchmark over kind of 5 years at least. And then in the last year, you've actually really jumped up the rankings a lot, both in terms of performance relative to the benchmark and to your peers. Why do you think that is?
I mean, I really focus on performance relative to the benchmark because this, you know, my whole approach, it being a mainstream approach and a diversified approach, is about beating the benchmark fairly consistently year to year, every year, such that over time it develops into, you know, a really quite a significant gap with the benchmark and hopefully as a result with peers. I don't focus too much on what peers are doing. I think some of them are doing very different things in terms of gearing or in terms of the style in which they're managing the assets. But I want people to buy the fund and hold it. And I think this approach of steadily outperforming the benchmark, is more likely to result in that rather than, perhaps a more aggressive approach. I think that's really what I've been focusing on. And, obviously it comes and goes from year to year, but generally over time, and especially with the extra tools I have at my disposal that we just discussed, and given the very, very strong support that I get from the Fidelity research effort, we certainly feel confident that we can continue this longer term outperformance.
Okay, great. And just finally, the dividend growth has also been quite impressive over the long term. What is your attitude to dividends? Are you committed to growing it or maintaining it, or what's the approach?
Yeah, the dividend on the trust itself really is obviously paid in sterling. So whereas I receive most of my dividends in euros or in other currencies, so the amount of dividend we can pay can be affected by factors that are outside anyone's control, i.e., changes in exchange rate.
So the weaker euro has been having an impact then?
Well, the weaker euro could have an impact on the dividend, but offsetting that are a few factors. I mean, obviously, the underlying rate of growth in dividends from the companies in which I invest in generally is pretty good and should generally over time be superior to the market rate of growth. So that'd be one offsetting factor. There are a number of other factors to do with costs and interest rates, etc. And also, ultimately, as you will know, an investment trust doesn't have to pay out all its earnings in 1 year in dividends. So sometimes over time, a reserve does build up, which can be utilized in the event of, extreme foreign exchange volatility, etc. But I think the basic aim of the trust is to pay out most of the income in dividends. We do take charges from income rather than from capital. So again, that slightly reduces the rate of dividend you get on the trust. But I think over time, obviously there may be year-to-year volatility, but over time, the dividend of the fund should reflect what I'm doing in the portfolio in terms of my strategy. It should grow.
Great. Well, I think that's probably about all we have time for. So thank you very much, Sam.
Brilliant. Thank you.
Well, that was a fascinating interview. In this week's magazine, I wrote in my Smart Money column that there's plenty of evidence that constant monitoring of investment news will raise your blood pressure. Sharp moves in stock markets, as we have seen this week as the Greek crisis unfolds, are closely correlated with a rise in heart attacks, according to some academic research. So instead, we've suggested that investors take some time away from monitoring the news flow and focus on getting the basics of investing right. And one of the most important things to get right is asset allocation. That's the right balance in your portfolio between equities, bonds, property, commodities and cash. And many advisors suggest that this asset allocation should change as you go through different life changes and different things happen to you and your risk profile changes. Now, this week's Portfolio Clinic features an investor who is thinking about his asset allocation. He's reached the grand age of 87 and he's worried that his equity-focused portfolio should be more conservatively invested. Now, Alan, do you think we should be investing more cautiously as we get older? I mean, I know that's a pretty broad question, but, the traditional advice is that you should have like fewer equities as you get older. What's your view?
Well, it's a really tough one. That, I've been doing this for a very long time, 42 years, and I've seen all sorts of things happening. I've seen all sorts of ends of the world and all sorts of theories. And this theory tends to assume, I think, that progress is linear. you know, that it's on a nice line. So at this point, you take a lot of risk, and as then you get older, because of the linear progress, you start taking less risk. But progress isn't like that, and markets aren't like that, and the world's not like that. The world goes in cycles, you know. I mean, there are four seasons, unless you're in Scotland, there's only one, which is winter. But there are four seasons, and it's the same in business cycles and economic cycles. So, you know, if you actually then assumed if you'd got to 2009 and were actually going further and further and down into caution, and you'd got to the bottom of caution, and you sat and thought, well, I'll just put it in cash or absolute return, then you would have missed this bull market. And this has been a very strong bull market. So I don't think it's as simple as that. And it also comes down to personal taste as well, or feelings. And, you know, like, if you are the kind of person who, when they hear that the stock market's fallen by a record amount of 1.2% or something, feels like you've got a heart attack coming on, then you shouldn't be in equities.
I mean, a lot of people now talking about longer timescales for investment. I mean, if you've accumulated a lot of assets over your lifetime, you're not necessarily going to use them. You're going to want to pass them on to your family. Doesn't that extend your investment timescale and the amount of risk you can take, because you're sort of passing it on to your children?
Yeah. But there is also one thing that our reader has not touched on, and that is that he's trying to make, you know, he's trying to create wealth and make a wee bit more, and he's concerned about, is he in the right sectors and is he in the right diversification? And right now he's sitting looking at an inheritance tax bill of about £320,000.
Oh dear, that's very steep. Yes.
So it's not just as, I think people have got to actually say, step back, you're right, step back, look at the big picture and say, you know, what if I die? You know, if Fred dies, then is Mrs. Fred as comfortable as he's been with all this playing around with stocks and shares and ISAs? And you know, he's clearly comfortable, or has been, but what's he like? Because research shows that most widows are confused, vulnerable, and they often just turn everything into cash.
So, I mean, in that sense, he might be better off getting a simpler structure to his portfolio that's much more easy to manage.
Yeah, yes. Absolutely. But I think also he should, I know I'm biased in this, although I'm independent, he really should go and find somebody he can trust who looks at all of these pictures and puts it together and then puts something in there that makes a lot of sense.
Or he could line someone up for after he's gone, I suppose, to help his widow, potential widow out.
But ladies like relationships. They like to be comfortable and feel comfortable with the person that's going to do that. Not to suddenly introduce them after Fred's gone.
Mm-hmm.
Makes more sense for her to have that relationship now and start to understand what risk is and how she understands risk. And feels comfortable. I think it's really important.
Yeah, so it's sort of a joint decision, and they've got to think that through.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Very sensible advice. Thanks, Alan. Also in this week's magazine, we take a look at investment trusts and the independent boards that can appoint or dismiss the trust's fund manager. And Leonora Walters has been looking into how proactive boards have been in relation to changing managers when performance is poor. Leonora, are boards doing their job, or is there room for improvement? What do you reckon?
Well, I think there's mixed opinions. The Association of Investment Companies reports there's been quite a high manager turnover over the last 18 months. But then some analysts actually think that boards still aren't doing enough, and that's not necessarily just relating to manager change. Alan Bailey of Canaccord Genuity feels that a lot of boards aren't doing enough share buybacks, share issues on behalf of investors, or using gearing, taking on debt to improve returns potentially. But what some other analysts investors I spoke to report, they say there's actually been an improvement in the last few years. So to quote one of them, while some boards are still asleep at the wheel, they're overall, they're better than they used to be.
Alan, many people say that the company structure of an investment trust with its independent board is an advantage over open-ended funds that don't have boards. Do you agree? Do you think there's any sense in that?
In theory, yeah, it sounds good. But so did RBS had an independent board. The banks had independent boards, non-execs and so on. And look what happened there. Yeah, in theory it sounds right, but you know, in the time I've been around, and once upon a time, not that terribly long ago, I was approached to see if I wanted to be on a board. The people who run these boards are not doing it for the money. Mm-hmm. That's
they're doing it for some money, aren't they? Well, they get paid.
Well, they get something like, on average, between 15 and 20,000 a year to turn up at four or more board meetings and be accountable. And under the new laws, they are directors, and that's an onerous responsibility. So I don't think they're doing it for the money. They might be doing it for the kudos. And I think a lot of boards are a bit like old clubs. And I don't think they have been active enough or proactive enough, frankly.
Well, I think to a lot of people, £20,000 for four meetings a year might sound like decent money. But I mean, it depends how hard you're expected to work for that, I suppose.
They've got a lot of responsibility. They have, you know, they get phone calls and so on. I mean, their job is to represent the shareholders. Mm-hmm. I think they've forgotten that. I think their job is to... I think if you have a board that's tends to stick together for a long time, what happens is you get really friendly with the manager. He becomes one of the chaps. And, you know, old Fred, I shouldn't say Fred because that's the reader. But, you know, you say, oh, well, John, you know, he's had a rough time, but he's one of the boys and things like that. And I actually think that complacency has come in. I really do. Mm-hmm. Just have to look at Alliance Trust.
Yeah, I mean that's a trust for our listeners who don't know that hasn't performed particularly well and came under attack from an activist investor earlier this year,
and allegedly spent £3 million defending it.
Yeah, we're still waiting to see if performance will turn around with that trust, aren't we? But I mean, going back to what you were saying about the boards themselves and this additional independence, you feel that then they're not really doing their job. But where they actually hold money in the trust themselves, the board directors, I mean, do you think that has an effect? I mean, if you're actually invested, because some of them aren't at all, are they? They just turn up to the meetings.
Yeah, but even I know one or two who are directors of investment trusts, and they do have significant holdings. But these significant holdings tend to be a small percentage of their overall wealth. So I don't think it. I honestly don't think it makes a lot of difference.
Yeah.
Really.
Okay. Well, thanks very much for your thoughts, Alan, on that. And now we're going to look at something completely different. That's exchange traded funds. They're passive investments that are traded on the stock market. And we're going to look at exchange traded funds that invest in bonds. These have actually been growing in popularity this year, but we're not really sure that investors have enough choice in the area. And Kate Bearley has been investigating. Kate, what have you found?
Yeah, I mean, that is what I found, really, that this seems to be an area of undersupply, and that seems to be what everyone in the industry is saying. I mean, when it comes to equities, there are tons of ETFs and they seem to kind of mushroom by the day. And the ETF market kind of has grown up around equities, but it's just not as popular when it comes to fixed income, which is strange because a lot of people say that, in fact, ETFs would be good for fixed income. And in fact, they're so popular generally that it's surprising almost that there hasn't been more development here. And particularly because since the start of the year, kind of when QE was announced, there was this obvious kind of flow into bonds across the whole market. And a lot of ETF providers say that they had record interest in bond ETFs across the board. Now, that's obviously turned around a bit in May with the big kind of bund sell-off. But it's clear that people want these products and that there is a bit of a shortage.
I mean, Alan, looking at the bond sector, should we be investing in bonds at all? How are you getting exposure for your clients in bonds, and how are you doing that within the portfolios?
But bonds, if we're talking about sovereign bonds in the main, fixed income bonds, they've been in a bull market since, what, 1981?
Mm-hmm.
And bull markets tend to turn into bear markets. Now, I know that a lot of people have been expecting a bear market to happen for some time, and obviously it hasn't turned into that bear route that everybody expected. The funny thing is, my experience tells me that when people stop talking about it and say, ah, well, it's not going to happen and it's going to be a plateau, that's the time for a sharp exit. Because I don't think bonds make a lot of sense at all right now. I really don't see inflation coming through anywhere. And I don't see, but I see interest rates at some point going up. And they are going to go up in the US probably in September, and they're going to go up in the UK. And it will be slight, and it will be very slow. But at some point, we're in waters at the moment that we haven't seen since the early 50s in terms of low interest rates. Low interest rates ain't going to continue. And when they start rising, bonds are going to get a bit of a pasting. And I actually think the ETFs are going to be pretty... If you've got a bond ETF, who's on the other side of the deal when everybody rushes for the exit?
That is true. And also, that's a kind of key point, actually, I think, with bond ETFs, is that they're very specific, unlike something like a strategic bond fund where the manager might move around between long, short duration and different kind of bonds. Here you would have to be very specific about what kind of bond you're taking exposure to. So that is a big risk there.
Well, I've only been doing this for 42 years and I still don't understand ETFs.
I think we have to congratulate you there, Alan, on your 40 years in business, don't we, with your firm?
That was yesterday.
Oh, right. Well, yeah. I hope you're celebrating in style.
Yes, well, we have a bit of a hangover this morning.
Oh, dear.
Thinking about bonds.
Back to specific investments. This week, we had a look at F&C Global Smaller Companies, which is another member of the Investors Chronicle's top 100 funds. Leonora, you took a look at this one and how it's been performing. What's the picture?
It's really good, actually. We include the fund in our IC Top 100 funds for reasons, including its strong performance. And this continues. It beats its sector average and the MSCI World UK X Small Cap Index over 1, 3, and 5 years. And its last financial year was good too. Both its net asset value and its share price total return beat its benchmark. Now, there were a number of reasons why it did well. And although it's a global fund, some of the interesting things that went on and that drove performance actually happened in the UK segment of the portfolio. The UK segment of the portfolio delivered 13.4% against 6.2% for the Numis UK Smaller Companies Index. And one of the reasons was takeovers. The investment trust, in its last financial year, had 9 holdings taken over. So it largely did well out of that because most of these holdings were taken over at a premium to what the trust bought them. An exception was Salamander Energy, which is an oil company. And obviously because of the fall in the oil price at the moment, oil companies can't really negotiate prices. But other than that, it was quite, it was a profitable time for trust in terms of takeovers. They've actually rejigged the UK portfolio a bit about as well. And reasons for this include the manager added to the UK weighting because he thinks the UK will perform better in relation to global markets in the year ahead. Another reason was they found it easy to identify new investment opportunities, largely as a result of lots of IPOs. Some of the ones invested in include Fever Tree Drinks. Now, this is a company that supplies mixers to restaurants and the catering industry, not just in the UK, across the world as well. And its managers see a lot of potential growth in this share, of which the share price has already increased since its launch.
Well, there's lots of positive things to look at there. I mean, Alan, in terms of, is it a good time for smaller companies, do you reckon? I mean, you don't like bonds, but, in the equity market, lots of people have been talking about going for the large, big defensive stocks with good dividends. I mean, should you be balancing that out with some smaller companies in your portfolio as well?
Yep, Absolutely. I came across a wonderful description of FTSE stocks. Somebody said, investing in FTSE stocks, especially the big ones, is like driving on an unfamiliar road going forwards by only looking in the rearview mirror. Now, if you're going to, because it's the past, these companies have got to the size they are because of the past. Small companies, I love small companies. I think they are undervalued. The F&C Global Small Company Fund's done really well. It's got 40% in the US as well, by the way,
mm-hmm.
and a couple of nice Japan holdings. But small companies, if you look historically at the small company market and you're prepared to be patient, you outperform the main indices every 10 years. And yet they've gone through a little ropey phase. And I like the whole idea of small caps, and I don't see them as being too much risk at the moment because they're undervalued. And the world is, and you look at all the technological changes that are going on, and if you look at the people like Apple and Google buying up the best small companies they can get their hands on, it's a great market. I think it's a wonderful market. And there are some really good managers. Dan Nichols is a good manager at Old Mutual in the small cap arena. Harry Nimmo at Standard Life takes a different view, but he's got a great record. I think this is a great time to be buying small caps.
Okay, well, that's a nice positive note to end on. Thanks very much. That's a thanks to our special guest, Alan Steele of Alan Steele Asset Management, and to Sam Morse of Fidelity European Values. And thank you also to my colleagues, Leonora and Kate at the Investors Chronicle. You can read more about asset allocation, investment trust boards, and bond ETFs in this week's issue of Investors Chronicle. Thank you for listening.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.